Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:22 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is March 30th. I thought we'd kick off with lithium because it's had an epic advance. And I think it's also appropriate to look at this on a log scale just to highlight how much it has gone up. So we can definitely see that there's been this really epic advance and prices have begun to moderate over the course of the last week, but they're not coming down. And the size of the move is much larger than the initial move higher that we had in 2014, because it in fact came from a lower level and has well exceeded the peak from back in 2016-17. Lithium is absolutely integral to the production of lithium-ion batteries, but it's not the most expensive component, but it's going to contribute to rising costs because it's not the only commodity that's going up. So perhaps more accurately, we can say that rising commodity prices are probably going to be an inhibiting factor in the cost compression of producing batteries. So that also then begs the question, how are battery prices going to become price competitive with internal combustion engines? And that's not an easy question to answer. So we could talk about efficiencies in producing them, but as demand rises, we'll need to come up with new sources of potential supply. And the higher prices go, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to see additional investment in all manner of alternative energy metals. So Allkem, which is the new name for Orocobre, is now pushing up out of this range, and it's been basically going sideways for the last 6 months. Then we have companies like Tesla, where the price has been rebounding. Now Tesla has done a pretty good job of ensuring that they have more ample access to supply for commodities, and that's certainly a testament to Elon Musk's determination to ensure that they've been able to capture as much or as many deals as was humanly possible to secure their access to those metals. But Tesla produces about 1 million cars a year, and you know, companies like Volkswagen and Toyota produced between 7.5 and 8.5 million cars. And 2021 wasn't a great year for production numbers. It was good for their profitability because they're making more on every car. But in terms of the absolute quantity of resources that would be required to electrify the entire automotive sector, well, then this vertically integrated model that Tesla has deployed, it's been possible because they're a relatively small producer. And they've been actively securing production contracts. And they've been very vocal in telling mining companies to go off and build the mines and that they will buy the supply. And those kinds of promises sound wonderful until one starts to think about, well, are they going to be able to sell all those cars? And then, of course, it comes down to regulation. So we've had a reasonably significant pullback in carbon emissions. And then we had a big rebound. And the price is now is holding steady over the course of the last while. Now, I think it's more likely than not that we're moving into more of a ranging phase. We have the competing arguments about whether the economy is going to slow and mitigate demand, or whether we're going to have a lot of infrastructure development and an acute need to develop more commodity supply. So those competing arguments are probably going to contribute to more ranging in carbon emission prices, but we're in the region of where the Europeans wanted the carbon emission price to be. They are ensuring that it's going to be cost prohibitive to continue to use internal combustion engines. Then you have governments talking about banning internal combustion engines, potentially even by 2030. And that's going to force a lot of the industrials to become much more, I think, acutely aware of the dangers of relying on globalization. When we have geopolitical tensions rising and volatility on the global stage, and particularly in view of the pandemic and the reliance on semiconductors or other parts, and then you have electrification, meaning that some of the suppliers aren't going to be able to survive, and they may not survive long enough to ensure the handover from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, because their margins are going to continually compress. So we're certainly in an interesting environment, but it does suggest that there's going to be continued demand for industrial resources, and infrastructure development is going to be a priority, because if the hallmark of globalization is a unified global supply chain, well, then the inefficiency of not being globalized means that supply chains need to be duplicated. So Germany, for example, has to go off and build importing facilities for liquefied natural gas, having just spent the money and the time and the effort to build, or to at least allow, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to be built. Then they are now having to basically shelve that and go off and build even more infrastructure. And the chances are that we're going to see this similar type of dilemma being faced by lots of different countries. So the copper miners ETF is back in the region of its highs, and it remains on a recovery trajectory overall. We can then think about the steel sector, and it's got a really similar pattern overall. Now, steel isn't viewed as a renewable energy metal, but there are tons of steel required for every new skyscraper-sized wind turbine, for the solar sector, and then for all of the infrastructure that's going to be required in building ports and rail, and then upgrading communications equipment. And all of that is absolutely essential if we're going to become more resilient in terms of the global supply chain. And or I guess it's really creating an alternative to the global supply chain. Then we started to see today that the dollar was starting to come back, and it's encountered resistance below this psychological 100 level. The primary supports for the dollar are that there would be a higher interest rate, or a wider interest rate differential, between the dollar and other currencies because of the supposed willingness of the Federal Reserve to raise rates, and that there would be less supply because they're about to engage in quantitative tightening. Well, quantitative tightening should be kicking off at some point in April. And the size of the Fed's balance sheet is hovering here around $8.96 trillion. And still rising on a month-over-month basis. So we're only at the beginning of the quantitative tightening cycle, and we're already at a point where the yield curve is inverted. Now, the yield curve was as low today as 2 basis points, and closing out the day closer to 3 and a bit. But this has been an incredibly profound contraction. When we look at the Wuxia shadow rate for the Fed funds rate, I think it's a rather interesting chart on the long term. And we can see here that the rate's currently at about 200 basis points, and it's quite unlikely that it's going to exceed 200 basis points, which would suggest that despite the fact that the Fed fund futures have priced in the scope for 8.25 basis point or 4.50 basis point interest rate hikes within the next 12 months, that it's an unlikely scenario. And that's potentially why the dollar is starting to pull back, that there has been a very rapid pricing in of the scope for interest rate hikes, aggressive interest rate hikes, and now we're starting to see some of that coming back off, because we're already in a tight financial condition environment. And when we then think about the bonds, they have been exceptionally oversold, so there's the potential for at least a rebound. And then we can think about this measure of financial conditions, where it got up to test the 1,000-day moving average, and now it's starting to come back down. So there's obviously a stock market component in the calculation of this measure, but what it also suggests is that there is at least a willingness to think that perhaps the market got a little bit over-enthusiastic with pricing in interest rate hikes, and that it's not the most likely scenario. Well, one of the reasons that gold had been pulling back from its early March peak was because of that fear of really excessive interest rate hikes. And as that bet comes off, it's starting to steady here around the $1,900 area. We've also seen that the gold shares have been firmer than the gold price, and it's the GDX is pushing back up into the upper side of this range, and even the explorers, which are down at the speculative end of the spectrum, are testing the 18-month sequence of lower rally highs, though they did not successfully break up and out of the base formation. And arguably that peak from back in 2016 is the upper side of the base. And I suspect that when we see gold finished regrouping and breaking out to new highs, then it's the speculative sector is going to perform best, because it's coming from a lower base. And these are the kinds of companies that will start to gain leverage, because they're not yet producing. So there is more uncertainty, but when they move from exploring to proofing up their resources, well, then that's when they start to really attract interest. I think it is interesting that companies like i80 and others are adopting a similar type of business model to what biotech companies have been doing. So we can think about i80 in that it named itself after a road, and that was simply to tell people we are next to a road, we don't need to go building any, and we're only down the road from a major producing mine, so hopefully they'll buy us out. And that's exactly what biotech companies have tended to do. They've basically gone through the proofing up process of their ideas, and then they hope to get bought out by the bigger pharmaceutical companies. And over the course of the last year, the biotech sector has basically amputated the major vaccine producers. So now the larger biotech companies are back in primary positions in terms of market weight within the ETF, and it is beginning to steady, at least from the region of the upper side of the underlying base formation. When we then think about how things are going internationally, the Chinese market today was in positive territory, and the renminbi was also quite a bit firmer. But it's looking like the CSI 300 has put in a higher reaction low. So this is at least clear evidence that we're starting to see support building coming through in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Then the Hang Seng has also been steadying. So we can potentially now think that this is also a higher reaction low, and that we can see a reversion back towards the 200-day moving average. The renminbi remains quite firm. So we haven't yet seen it break in a substantial way. It's certainly been, it's broken the sequence of lower rally highs, but hasn't devalued. China doesn't want to see very volatile moves. So they're doing what's necessary to ensure that the property market doesn't go bust, but they don't want to stoke a property bubble or to reinflate the bubble. So when we think about where's the liquidity going to come from to stoke asset price appreciation around the world, China's a potential source, but they are not going to be as generous in the quantity of liquidity that they pump out into the rest of the world, as I think many people are hoping for. And the yen has also been firming over the course of the last couple of days. Now, it accelerated to test that 125 area, and now we're starting to see it pull back and unwind the short-term oversold condition. The Bank of Japan today said that they were willing to buy as many bonds as people were willing to sell for a yield of 25 basis points. So that is confirmation of what the market was pricing in. So there's a little bit of selling the rumor to buy the news to this type of activity. But it's hard to imagine why the yen should be firming if the Bank of Japan is going to continue to defend the 25 basis point level. But yields are starting to come back down. So when we think about German Bunds, they had pushed up into positive territory in a very rapid manner, moving 70 basis points in the space of, or maybe 75 basis points in the space of less than a month is really an extraordinary move. And it does look like we're going to see at least some pause and consolidation. Even if this is still an uptrend, it's likely that we're going to see it pull back and then potentially find support in the region of the previous peak, which is probably closer to about the 35 basis point level. And if bond yields are going to pull back, well, stocks have been highly correlated to bond yields. So if we're starting to see some money flowing back into the bond markets, well then potentially it's going to start coming out of stocks. So the S&P 500 was in mildly negative territory today. Certainly nothing like a dynamic move that would cap the advance, but we are at a potential area of resistance, which is the region of the peak from February and the lower side of the overhead trading range. So it's likely that we're going to see at least some consolidation here. And of course, we're still in an environment where the Federal Reserve wants growth to slow. And a lot of central banks around the world have been raising interest rates. And perhaps one of the places which is going to see outsized consumer demand is Australia, because Australia has been locked down for much longer than most of the rest of the developed world, and now it's opening back up again. And there's a lot of people with excess savings that want to go out and start enjoying life again. So the ASX is back testing its peak and is rebounding faster than most of the European markets. And the European markets are still recovering, but they're in negative territory today and still haven't quite unwound the oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. One thing that I think is interesting right now is that we've seen bond yields that have popped on the upside, but bank shares have been lagging. So European banks have rebounded, and they're just about unwinding the oversold condition relative to both the 1,000 and 200-day moving averages. And the S&P 500 banks index is also coming back into the region of the 200-day moving average, and then it was easier in here today. So this looks like it's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average and the lower side of that overhead trading range. So it's not a bullish chart. Now, the performance of banks is particularly important because they're liquidity providers. And if we're going to have a recovery and a bull market overall, well, then banks should do well. So Australian banks are pushing up to test their highs. Now, we might see some pause in consolidation over the next while. And Australia has basically abandoned its yield curve control. And the Australian dollar is back in the region of the peaks from back in November. And it has broken the medium-term sequence of lower rally highs. We might see a little consolidation, but it does look like it's on a recovery trajectory overall, and not least because of commodity demand picking up. So when we think about the LME Metals Index, obviously there has been a lot of volatility because of the nickel price being shut down. But and it is overbought in the short term, but this was a really big breakout from an exceptionally lengthy range. And as long as the breakout holds, well, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So we've got a couple of different competing themes here. The first is that we've had the big shock of the pandemic, the big rebound. Now we're getting the inflation that came as a result of that rebound. In order to get that rebound under control, there might be the need to have a recession to squeeze out some of the excesses. But ultimately, we're in a geopolitically tense environment where there's going to be a great deal of focus on trying to replace a lot of infrastructure. And that ultimately is going to require money printing. That's the primary reason why gold is in a new bull market, because in order to do what's necessary to circumvent the global supply chain, then there's going to have to be a lot more spending. The money's going to have to come from somewhere. And the purchasing power of the currency with which all that infrastructure is built is likely to deteriorate. So I think this is sort of the way that we can anticipate markets evolving. And there'll be a greater focus on income and dividend growth and healthy balance sheets within the corporate sector, and the kinds of companies that are living on a promise and don't have the potential to really boost their cash flow, well, they're probably going to suffer. We've already started to see that pressure is coming to bear on the private equity sector and valuations within the private sector. Now, obviously, there are other portions of the private equity sector which have a lot of attractive qualities, and particularly because they're not correlated. And I was in a meeting this morning about viatical settlements, and those are a perfectly non-correlated assets. But there's lots of these types of non-correlated assets within the private sector. But then there's also been a lot of investment in highly speculative assets, which are highly correlated to the economic environment and global liquidity, which means that there's going to be a lot of trading around these private sectors, and the size of the private equity market has ballooned over the course of the last 15 years. So this is something that's rather difficult to monitor from a market's perspective, but it does have an impact on pensions who have been plowing money into the private sector. And then the rise in yields means that there will be a bid for bonds. And if pensions can capture a higher yield, they will invest. And there will be money, and there's certainly a lot of dry powder in the private sector. So we're going to see more focus on cash flow. There will probably be a lot more privatizations as well. And one, for example, is Nielsen. It's one of those companies that tends to pop up on value screens for lots of companies, but now it's probably going to get taken private. So that's been behind the big pop on the upside here. Now, that also suggests that there will be fewer shares outstanding, which should help to support prices and could help to mitigate any downward, significant downward pressure. So I do not think that we're going to have a bear market like we had in 2008. And I think that instead, what we're more likely are the worst possible scenario is a good-sized pullback, enough to scare central banks into easing once more. But we're not quite there yet. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.